G'day, Chris. How are you going?
G'day, Phil. Well, thanks.
Not everyone will know Chris. Many people will know him quite well for a long time, and other people won't know him so well at all. So just say a couple of things about yourself, Chris, that would be of interest to those who are here, about what you do, what the other side of Chris Mulhere and the people don't see when you roll up to church, perhaps.
Right, the other side. Well, currently, in terms of vocationally, I have two jobs that add up to a full-time job. I teach philosophy 2 days a week at Catholic Theological College, and my main role is 3 days a week running ISCAST, Christianity and Science in Conversation, which I'll say a little bit more about in a minute. The genetic abnormality of our family is we had 5 sons and we have 8 grandsons.
Yeah, very impressive.
And for those who are calculating, I think it's up to 1,000 and one in 1,000 and whatever the 2 to the power of 13
wow.
is.
Yeah, of course. Probability that's extremely slim. Goes on and on. Lindy will rejoice when a granddaughter comes along. I'm sure she'll be absolutely thrilled.
Yeah, it'd be an odd thing to happen. Yeah.
Not that she wouldn't be thrilled with another grandson, I'm sure. Yeah. Okay. That's great. So Chris put together this really snappy graphic there. I think that the human hand is more an artificial hand, but it looks somewhat human. Maybe that's part of the theme. But I'll just pray for Chris briefly before he jumps in and shares with us. Now, at the end of, if you have any questions for Chris, just hang on to your questions till the end of the talk, because you're happy to field questions, obviously.
Yep.
And we'll take them there. So I'll just pray for Chris to get things going. Father God, thank you for Chris. Thank you for the man that you've made him, for the faith that you've invested into him, and that he has a passion for you, to serve you, has a passion to bring science and faith together and to show the world that science and faith do agree and they can have a happy marriage. And pray for Chris as he leads us in this talk, that he might open our eyes to some truths about you and some of the really interesting and cool things about science as well, and how we can respond to that in our changing world. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thanks, Phil. Just a fraction more about me that has perhaps relevance to speaking about this subject today. I am no expert on, well, for that matter, I'm no expert on anything except maybe having boys or grandsons or something like that. So I'm a jack of all trades. I started in engineering and taught engineering for a bit and then did philosophy, went into ministry and did theology. So I have a grounding in those things. But as I said, I'm not an expert. And I run ISCAST. Now, what have I done? I've left the clicker down there. Excuse me. I can't advance the slides without the clicker. I run ISCAST. It's an organisation that's been around for about 40 years, and we try to promote a constructive conversation between science and Christian faith. We are committed to mainstream science. Mainstream science probably has it right. Mainstream science doesn't always get it right, but we believe that mainstream science is our best way of accessing the truth about the natural world, and we are committed to historical, orthodox, creedal Christian faith. And we believe that those two commitments can go hand in hand, and that there is no necessary fundamental conflict between those two commitments. But we also think it's a great shame that some people anyway, many people actually, seem to think that you can't be committed to Christian faith and committed to science at the same time. We like to remind people that over history, many, many people who are known as scientists, who are known for their science, have also been Christian believers. Two of the people on the screen there, in the middle row, left, Graham Clark, and next to Graham, Cheryl Prager. Both have won the Prime Minister's Prize for Science. So has Ken Freeman. All three of those people are fellows of ISCAST. They're all alive today here in Australia. Other people there, many of you would know Tony Rinaldo's face there, top left there. and many others. In fact, the scientific revolution was given to us effectively by people who believed in a creator God who made the universe and who offers the universe as a reflection of who God is, and science as the means of exploring the handiwork of the Creator. So this is the message that we are trying to promote. And in particular, in schools, one of the reasons that we want to promote this message is because in our surveys of now up to roughly 3,000 school students, in faith-based schools, not government schools, faith-based schools, about 60% of those students think that science and faith are in conflict. So we are working in schools, and our big picture aim is to work with any particular school over the span of their secondary years so that no secondary student in that school leaves school thinking that Christian faith is not a credible option. Now, we can't make Christians, we can't evangelize explicitly in schools, but we can do our best to open people's minds and try and combat this myth. Let me give you one more taste before we get on to the main topic of conversation. Sarah Sweet is an astrophysicist in Brisbane. This photo is, I was actually in Brisbane 2 weeks ago with Sarah in a school, but this photo is an older one from another school, St Margaret's School in Brisbane. 2 weeks ago we were at St Paul's. Sarah tells the students about the wonders of the universe. She also talks about her Christian faith. She also talks about being a mother of four children and basically offers an integrated picture of somebody who can be a Christian, a full-time scientist, a mother, etc. That's the message that we want to get across, and there you have a taste of it. Excuse me. Back to the topic in hand. Servant or saviour, AI and techno-utopianism. Although somebody did mention this morning I should use a font with serifs, because you might read that as, who is Al? Al and techno-utopianism. As you know, artificial intelligence has hit the news in the last 2 or 3 years particularly. It's hit the news because of something called large language models, led by one called ChatGPT, which is the product of a company called OpenAI. But before I get into a little bit more depth, let me just tell you what we're going to do today. We're going to think about the AI revolution a little bit, or at least the revolution that's become very obvious in the last 2 or 3 years, although AI has been around for a long, long time. We're going to think about the ethical challenges raised by AI, and then we're going to go a little bit broader and think about what I'm calling techno-utopianism. The AI wave is part of a bigger wave. You probably have come across the name of Elon Musk and others who I would call techno-utopians. They think that utopia, the good life, can be offered by science and technology, and that science and technology are the answer, effectively, to all possible human problems, to all possible planetary problems. And finally, I'm going to mention some theological issues that I think are serious questions for those people who are Christians. I'm not assuming everybody here is a Christian, but from a Christian point of view, there are some serious core Christian convictions which challenge what I'm calling techno-utopianism. And finally, before we get into the actual AI revolution, here's a question that some people might ask, which I'm going to respond to very briefly. why should Christians even engage with techno-science? Surely we should just leave technology and science to technologists and the scientists, and we as Christians should gather together in church on Sunday, we should do our Bible studies and not get too involved in, you know, the world of technology and science. Well, here are my five reasons why I think Christians ought to be thoroughly engaged with techno-science, that is to say, science and its products in technology. Firstly, because science is a huge cultural force today, and if Christians want to be engaged with our culture, we have to think about the place of science, particularly in a world that is increasingly less religious, or at least increasingly less Christian, although people still call themselves spiritual. I think science is a big cultural force and we ought to take note of it for that reason. Another reason is the reason that all of those people that gave us the scientific revolution, what they thought too about what came to be called science. It wasn't called science then, it was called natural philosophy then. It came to be called science in the late 19th century. They believed that science reveals the hand of the Creator. God made this world, this natural world, therefore science is an uncovering of the wonders of the Creator. Thirdly, because technology fulfills the creation mandate. The creation mandate is what we sometimes call that call to the first humans to populate the world and to steward the world. Steward's probably the best translation, although we call it, at least in the original, we talk about dominion. But it's, in the words of Ian Hoare Lacy, who was, many of you would know and a member here, it's responsible dominion. What does it mean for human beings as the highest species on the planet, made in the image of God, unlike any other species? What does it mean for us to have this power, this responsible dominion? Well, we are called, according to the Bible, we are called to have responsible dominion, to use that power for good. Fourthly, we are also called to be salt and light. When it comes to conversations about how technology should be used, Christians should be part of that conversation, involved in the conversation about what the ultimate good is, what we ought to be aiming at, what is the common good, how can AI be used for good and not for evil, for example. And the final reason that I think Christians should be involved with techno-science is because I think that science is a gateway drug for many, many people. That is to say, for people who don't call themselves religious, they will go bushwalking, they will look at the stars, and they will have a sense of awe and wonder at the natural world. Why do they have that sense of awe and wonder? It's a little bit like Richard Dawkins. Professor Richard Dawkins was at the World Atheist Convention here in Melbourne, and he started his talk saying words to the effect, "It is an amazing universe. Don't ever take your life for granted. You ought to be grateful." But there is no one to be grateful to. That sense of awe, wonder, gratefulness even, worship even, that people have in the face of the natural world is, I think, can be a gateway drug as we help people to think about why is it that we respond this way to whatever it is, sunsets or waves on the beach or whatever it happens to be. So there's my call for Christians to be engaged with techno-science and to do what we can to be part of the conversations. Let's think briefly about the AI revolution. I'm not sure if any of you have seen this video. I'm not going to show the video, but this is to leap forward to the very latest of what AI is able to do. It was a video of two people trying to board a plane with their companion kangaroo, who is holding the boarding ticket there, trying to board the plane and having an argument with the stewardess about whether the kangaroo would be allowed to come on board the plane. The video is indistinguishable from, if you like, a real live video. It was totally created with AI. We've got to the point where, unfortunately, I'll offer a different point of view on that in a minute, but unfortunately, you can't believe any video or anything you read on the internet. You can't assume that it hasn't been written by a machine, even what appear to be very, 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 very realistic videos. I say there's another side to that. Maybe there's a good side to that too. Maybe the good side, when everybody realises that you can't believe what you read online or what you see online, maybe the good side to that is it will push us back towards relationships. And maybe you people in this room, at least those of you who are convinced that I am not an AI, maybe you people in this room will take more note of what I say today because of the relational element, because you know where I come from, than if you just read it somewhere and you didn't know whether it had been written by ChatGPT or one of the other large language models. So, large language models are where most of us came across AI in the last 3 or 4 years. Large language models are essentially a computer system based on the way that the human brain works. They're called neural networks, and we don't have to go into them, and not even the computer scientists can quite track what's going on inside a neural network, which is another problem. But the neural networks in very large computer systems are able to take millions and millions and millions of photographs of a cat, turn them into numbers, a matrix, and then when they are fed in a new photograph, that photograph is turned into numbers, and the numbers of the new photograph are compared to all the photographs, which have been turned into numbers, of what are already labelled cat, and the computer system can say, this is a cat, in fact, this is a Siamese cat, etc., because of the correlation between the numbers that this new photo got turned into and all of those millions of numbers that are its, quote, training data. The training data is done by human beings. Somewhere, not in Australia, but in parts of the world where people are paid a lot less, people are looking at photos of cat and saying, that's a cat. That's a cat. That's a cat. In other words, training the computer system with billions of bits of information so that when it gets fed a new photo or when somebody says, please create a video of a Siamese cat climbing a wall and leaping onto the roof of my house and the address of my house is such and such, the AI can put all that together and create that video for you. However, what's going on in the processing of those numbers in the neural networks of massive computer systems, no computer scientist can track. It's not like an old style algorithmic computer system that has a code and any computer scientist who knows what they're doing can track the code and work out exactly what the computer is doing at every point. That's not how the neural network system works. And then moving on to large language models, what this neural network can do is, having been trained now after a number of years of training, the big AI models have been trained on all the information that is publicly available on the internet. Having been trained on all of that information, if you write a sentence or if you ask a question, these systems can produce what is the most statistically likely response. That's all that a large language model is doing. It will produce grammatically correct text. simply by having been trained on all the information that's out there and all the books that OpenAI can access. And there are now copyright claims against these companies because they've used copyright books to train their models on. These models can now produce text, they can now produce essays. I was saying to somebody before in my work teaching philosophy, any reasonably clever student can use an AI model to write an essay for them and then tweak the essay slightly so that we cannot tell that it's been written by AI. That's raised a huge question for people in education, because for many people in education, the way of assessing a student's work has been to get a student to write an essay, particularly in philosophy, to get a student to write an essay on a particular subject. What is Aquinas's third proof for the existence of God, and offer two or three criticisms of it and how you would respond to the criticisms. If we were doing a demonstration today, I could put that into ChatGPT. I would say it needs to be approximately 2,000 words and it needs at least 10 or 15 references, including references to the primary source, to Aquinas, and it would produce an answer within seconds, less than a minute. It would produce a 2,000-word essay that was quite likely to be completely correct and in perfect grammatical English. With a little bit of tweaking, just to add a little bit of the student's personality into it, the teacher would not even suspect that it had been written by an AI. So if you've heard that AI can be detected, it's very difficult to detect. And as I say, these are problems that people in education are going through. So the large language models do that. We have image generation, we have video generation, and we also have decision making. That is to say, you can give an artificial intelligence the ability to make decisions in circumstances where you haven't given it strict rules. So if an artificial intelligence is driving an automatic car, a car without a human driver, you can't possibly give it every single possible situation that it's going to come across. In other words, you have to allow the AI to, quote, make a decision in an unforeseen circumstance, which is what human beings do all the time in a split second. You're driving up a road you've never driven up before, you come to a corner that looks sharper than you thought it was, and at the same time something else goes wrong and there's a car coming on the other side of the road. In that split second, you make a decision, but it's not a situation that could have been foreseen in the sense of making a rule for that particular case. So the AI is given the power, quote, to make that decision. There are a number of questions raised, ethical questions, raised by the dawning of this amazing power of artificial intelligence. Let me just briefly introduce you to a number. One is the data set problem. AI works by amassing vast amounts of information. It may be true information, it may not. It may be public information, or it may not. It may be private information. There is a whole lot of information out there in databases around the world about you that if you saw it all in one place, you would probably think, I didn't want this information to be out there. If you're a grandparent, it's probably pretty easy to find out the names, dates of birth, schools they go to of your grandchildren. So there's a whole lot of questions about how the data is used and how it's controlled. The hallucination and accuracy problem. We need to remember that AI makes up answers. AI has no sense of truth or morality. It makes up answers according to the statistical programming that it's been fed. So it gives you the most statistically likely answer within the framework, because the AI manufacturers do create boundaries, if you like. There are some questions that an AI will not answer, or will not answer in a particular way. If you ask AI an IED, an explosive device, it will probably say, "That's outside my bounds," simply because that's one of the limitations that's been put on it. But we need to remember, the point is, we need to remember that AI makes up answers, and unless it's making an IED, if you ask AI a question, it will normally give you an answer, even if there is no answer. So if you say, for example, and I haven't tried this one, in what year in the 12th century did Columbus arrive in what we now know as South America, you may well get a convincing sounding answer, even though Columbus didn't sail until 1492. In other words, it will make up the most statistically likely answer. Hence, whenever you use ChatGPT or others, there's always this warning: please check the answers. Don't assume they're true, because AI has no sense of what the word true means. All it knows is what's statistically likely from the information it's been fed. The alignment problem relates to the fact that AI has no intrinsic morality. There is no alignment between what we might call the common good and what AI might the output of an AI system. So there is always this problem of whether an AI is aligned to the values of the people who are setting up the system or using the system. This relates to the autonomy problem, because we are increasingly giving AI the ability to make decisions. As we do that more, decisions as we do that more and more, there are very, very significant dangers if an AI makes a mistake. If, hypothetically, an AI is a computer system, is making split-second decisions about the Australian power grid, and it's doing it not based on a set of rules, but rather a set of principles, if you like, and we haven't foreseen every circumstance, what happens if, hypothetically, one state, the power goes down in one state, and the AI decides to divert power to that state, causing a brownout in all the other states without any warning, and certain hospitals finish up without power, and we hope their generators come online. But the point being, more and more, quote, decision-making is being given to these AIs because they are able to cope with enormous amounts of data. Now, we've seen this for a long time. We've seen this in the share market, for example. For a long time, the share market has been run on a rules-based system of automatic decision-making. But AI goes one step beyond the rules-based system to that neural network that I described before, where the rules, where there are no explicit rules, or there are more than just explicit rules. Finally, the black box problem, which I've already mentioned. No computer scientist in the world knows exactly why ChatGPT spat out this particular answer today and tomorrow might spit out a different answer. It's not a rules-based system. Let me move on now to what I'm calling the transhumanist vision and to more about techno-utopianism. But before that, I thought I'd introduce you to this man. Does anybody know who this is? Does anyone recognise this face? Sorry?
Sam.
Sam who?
Altman.
Sam Altman. Who's Sam Altman?
He runs OpenAI.
He runs OpenAI. He gave us ChatGPT. He's the person that has led the charge in the last two or three years. Sam Altman is a techno-utopian in the way I use the words. He thinks that technology is the way to fix all human problems. Whether they are your problems, like that knee that's been hurting lately, or your desire to live longer, or your desire, if you're a bit younger, to have a child with blue eyes, blonde hair, and an amazingly high IQ, or whether it's climate change, or whatever the problems might be, the techno-utopians are those who say the way forward is to use technology, and AI is clearly so powerful, it will take us there. Brian Johnson is a techno-utopian who's spending $2 million per year on what he thinks is the perfect health regime for himself, part of which includes taking blood from his son there and injecting his son's blood in him. He takes many, many pills every day, has a rigorous exercise routine and eating routine. Brian Johnson's aim is to live forever. Brian Johnson thinks that technology is advancing faster than his own ageing. In other words, for every year that he ages, technology will give him more than a year of extra life. In other words, he will never catch up to the day that he dies because using technology, he hopes to live forever. I can hear Christian theological questions about everlasting life. We'll get to them. So this is called transhumanism. Transhumanism is doing with technology all that we can do for the human body, for advancing the human body beyond what we would normally call wellness to, quote, in the words of one of them, we want to be better than well. We don't just want to be well, we want to be better than well. So instead of therapy, we're moving to enhancement. It's about improving, it's about living longer, living forever as the ultimate goal. And in one person's words, it's an ideology, a secular version of immortality on its own terms. Let me quote Ray Kurzweil, who is still, I believe, a senior engineer at Google, but a futurist. I think he calls himself a futurist. This leads to computers having human intelligence, our putting them inside our brains, connecting them to the cloud, expanding who we are. Today it's here in part and it's going to accelerate. We're going to get more neocortex. We're going to be funnier. We're going to be better at music. We're going to be sexier. We're really going to exemplify all the things that we value in human beings to a greater degree. Now, I'm going to move a little bit faster because I'm conscious that I'm not meant to speak forever. Of course, doing things with the human body has been around for a long time. Graham Clark, a Melbourne person, invented the bionic ear. He was taking technology and doing what they thought was impossible at Melbourne Uni many years ago in the 70s, doing what they thought was impossible, connecting an electronic box, effectively, to the human brain and allowing people to hear and allowing them to speak. So technology is not, obviously not all bad, and it means it's very difficult to work out where the lines ought to be between what we ought to do and what we ought to steer away from. Back to the extremes of techno-utopianism, I'm calling this one techno-redemption. There are philosophers, in fact, one prominent Australian philosopher trained at Monash, now at Oxford, his name is Julian Savulescu, who makes the argument for fixing the human body at the genetic level, at the embryo level, before an embryo becomes a person, before they are born, fixing the genetics of the embryo so that no human being will cause acts of what they call ultimate harm. Recognising that we live in a world where one individual human being can cause enormous harm, particularly if they have power over a biohazard laboratory or nuclear weapons or whatever it happens to be, we ought to program human beings genetically so that we program out anything that might lead to a person becoming a psychopath, or a person, maybe just a person losing control. Maybe domestic violence could be dealt with by genetic engineering at the embryo level. So this is the argument for moral enhancement. It's a technological fix for sin, if you like. Because for the transhumanist, human sin is a real problem. Transhumanists see plenty that's wrong that needs fixing with human beings, but they think that the answer is in technology. Therefore, our responsibility is to morally enhance future humans to prevent evil. Here's the argument summed up. Given that technology will increasingly give all of us the power to inflict ultimate harm, either quickly and individually in the case of bioterrorism, or slowly and collectively in the case of climate change, what needs to change is us. If the world will blow up if just one of us pushes the self-destruct button, or if all of us won't stop pushing the climate change button, then what we need are human beings who can be trusted not to push that button. What we need are better people. Therefore, according to this argument, what we need to do and what we now almost have the power of doing is to genetically change human beings at the embryonic level. I don't know if you caught up with the case of KJ Muldoon. Approximately a month ago it was announced. A baby, KJ Muldoon, was born about going on a year ago. Born with a disease that would inevitably lead to his death. But it's a genetic disease. And at 6 months old, for the first time, he was given genetic therapy to change his genetic code in his body. The genetic code is the code that tells our bodies how to grow. And it's found in almost all of the cells of our bodies. He was given medication to change the genetic code. So geneticists around the world, geneticists and whoever else has to make these things, they worked very hard for months to make a cocktail for this particular person to change his genetic code, and they did it. And 3 months after that, it was announced about a month ago, he's doing pretty well, and it looks like it might have been successful. The problem is they've changed his genetic code. They've changed it for the better in the case of this particular problem that he had, but they don't have any idea what other side effects it might have as the new genetic code governs the growth of this person. The even more radical development that happened a number of years ago now was when a Chinese scientist announced that he had genetically changed the code in embryos, and two embryos had been born, twins had been born with a changed genetic code. And the radical nature of that one is that having changed the genetic code at that point, those twins will pass on that genetic change to their offspring. Now, in the KJ Muldoon case, I don't think that's the case, but even if it is, it was a case of a child that was going to die, and it was a case of changing this one child rather than making a change to the genetic code of a human being that would be passed on down the line. When we don't know the consequences of this, we have the power to do it, but we don't know the consequences. I'm going to finish because I'm sure I've raised lots of ideas, perhaps in a haphazard manner, that'll raise questions. But I'm going to finish by asking these six questions, and I'm not going to go into them in depth. But these are six points at which I think Christian theology and the techno-utopian dream of their different versions, whether it's Sam Altman's version or Brian Johnson's version or Elon Musk's version, whoever it is, I think this is where Christianity comes clashing up against techno-utopian dreams. One is, there is no agreement about what the common good is. Elon Musk thinks, if I could paraphrase him, and he might disagree, but Elon Musk thinks that the common good is best served by being able to travel to Mars and make a civilization on Mars. Escape planet Earth for those that can afford it. What is the common good is a very difficult question in our society, but Christians have a much clearer conception of what the common good is. What is our theology of sin? Christians have a deep understanding of things that are wrong with human beings, wrong with the planet too, and also a deep conviction that ultimately only God can sort that out. While we do what we can, only God can ultimately sort it out. Technology is not going to sort out the problem of sin. Again, the problem of redemption, that's part and parcel of the same thing, and of the last point there, life everlasting. All of these are questions where Christians have clear convictions that go in the face of what the techno-utopians are saying. Finally, two more. The body. Christians are convinced that our bodies are part of what the essential me is. We are not just an amount of data that could be hypothetically downloaded and uploaded to a computer or whatever. We are, in part, our bodies, and our body matters. And even at the end of our lives, 1 Corinthians 15 talks about the body being resurrected, whatever that means. And finally, suffering. While Christians do their best to ameliorate suffering, we have a much more nuanced understanding of suffering. We believe that God can use suffering. We believe that suffering can be good for us. We also believe that God suffered, and that suffering is somehow part of what it means to live in this world in the here and now. One day we look forward to all suffering ceasing, but right now suffering is part and parcel of what it means to be human, even while we do our very best to eliminate suffering. Those are all points where I think Christians have very different answers to techno-utopians. I'm going to finish there, and I'm sure I've gone well over time. Sorry, Phil. But over to you.
Yeah, I can. No doubt, Chris has got some questions going in the crowd out there. I can run the microphone around, but yeah, I've got a couple. But let's go, Jacob.
Thanks, Chris. I'm not going to pretend that this is a question. It's a few comments, and there is a question at the end. The first thing I wanted to just say was with the neural network stuff in particular. It's not that we can't literally work out what the neural network does, right? Because as you said, it's just numbers. You put in a bunch of numbers and it spits out a bunch of numbers. Mm-hmm. But it's just that none of the things inside the neural network have any meaning to us. It's kind of like you can go in to the framework of the neural network, have a look, if I put in these numbers, work out exactly what happens, but it abstracts it so far from what is anything meaningful to humans that it's effectively just, you have no idea what's going on. Unless you work with some incredibly, incredibly simplified neural networks. So the leading edge of mathematics at the moment and probability is actually looking through neural networks and working out what is possible, blah, blah, blah. But it's kind of like studying, they're kind of like studying a toy car and like struggling to understand this toy car. Meanwhile, we have self-driving vehicles that are going on the roads so that, you know, a toy car will tell you a little bit, but not that much. So that was just the first comment. The other is...
So just to respond to that. So in that case, you'd like me to change whatever I said to quote what you said and just say, we have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm happy
with
that.
No, it's just, I think that it's like...
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I'm not a computer scientist. I was quoting a guy who's done AI at Cambridge for 40 years. But I'm happy with we have no idea what's going on inside the neural network.
For, you know...
That's the point.
We have no idea exactly. Yeah, sure. That's important. The other ethical things that I think it's also important to add on to the ethical dilemmas is particularly in chatbots, there's quite a rise in, if you think about what is the incentive structure of a chatbot, well, it's kind of to get you to keep using it. So if you go to ChatGPT, if you've ever done it.
A chatbot, for everybody's information, is when you get into having a chat, an online chat with an AI of some sort or other.
Like ChatGPT is the classic example. Yep. There was a recent update, I'm not sure if it's still out, you ask ChatGPT, you say, based on my history, having a conversation with you, what do you reckon my IQ is? And you get everybody who uses it to ask it that, and it'll give everybody, your IQ is definitely above average, significantly above average, you're really good at thinking, blah, 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 and it praises you excessively in ways that are just not true. Now, that's kind of a bit of a harmless one. But beyond that, it will also give you the answers. Again, it wants you to hear. So if you say to ChatGPT, hey, I've been hearing from God and I've been hearing these voices and I'm really struggling. It's been telling me to leave my family, desert them. There's this leader that is really, really strong, and I think he also really hears from God, and I need to abandon society. Do you think I'm making the right decision? It can say something like, that's really brave of you, Jacob. You should definitely follow what you've been hearing. Don't let the haters, blah, blah, blah. Yep. And so there's these issues, and there's an increasing rise in these for AI that it'll just tell you what you want to hear. So, I mean, that's kind of the counterpoint to, again, you're saying maybe it'll lead us to real human connection again and we'll have to actually chat to people to work out, are you telling the truth? Am I telling the truth? What's happening here? And I am worried that that will happen for some cases, and in other cases, people will go, my ChatGPT understands me better than my mom, dad, partner, these sorts of things. The final thing is actually a question.
I'll take the first two as a comment.
Yeah, the first two, the question is discuss. The last one, the question is, do you think that in using... do you think that as humans, we should take on the moral responsibility for the actions that the AI we create have? So in self-driving cars, it's the most obvious. Self-driving cars crashes into somebody and kills them. Do humans have a moral obligation as, I created this thing, Like, I think of the Old Testament, it's like, if you have a goat or a cow or something and it eats another human or it rips off an arm of another human, then you have to pay for that. Is there something going on here? If you have an artificial cow and it... Does that question make sense? Or not really?
I can hear where you're going.
ChatGPT said it was a great
question.
I'm not sure
about transferring Leviticus-type rules straight into self-driving cars is going to work for me. Our moral responsibility, for Christians, we understand that our moral responsibility is to love God and love our neighbour, if we sum it up that way. If we do our best to make aeroplanes to transport people around the world and we think that that's a good thing to do, it doesn't mean that we're responsible when a plane goes down because of something that was unforeseen. But it does get back to what we're creating these things for and whether we take due consideration of all the possibilities. So, you know, that's a bit of a vague answer, but there may be some circumstances where a car company will get sued for the accidents caused by their cars because they clearly did something wrong. In other circumstances, there may not. You know, Boeing got into a lot of trouble because two planes went down because they had done something wrong. When the AI effectively took over and the pilots didn't even know what was going on and put the planes into a nosedive. There was culpability there. So sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't, depending on the circumstances, I reckon.
Are these AI people that are developing it, are they trying to take over from God, to put themselves in that position, or are they merely doing it in the name of science?
If you ask my personal opinion, and this is a little bit of a psychological sort of interpretation of what's going on, remembering that the people that are leading this vanguard are predominantly billionaire males, white or Indian. Now, whatever that tells you, that's statistically correct, I think. There are a number of Indian people. An Indian person runs Google. Now, whether that's got anything to do with anything, I don't know. I'm not making a racist comment.
No.
But I'm saying that there are a very, very select little group of people who are leading this charge. In my opinion, and they are also people who love technology, obviously. And you know that if you take any general random group of people, some of them will be people who love technology, some of them will be people who say, you know, my mouse isn't working, I don't know how to make it work, and somebody needs to tell them to change the battery or to check the Bluetooth settings or something. But you've got this group of people who, in my opinion, are probably very, very similar psychologically. And I think if I were disparaging, and it's a little bit disparaging, but the way I describe it is I think they're boys with toys. I think they love playing with their toys. They enjoy the power, but it's not because they're setting out to be God or rule the world or anything. They've just got these enormously powerful toys at their disposal, and they just know that they could be more powerful next month or next year, and they just want to keep on pushing it to see where it goes. And they don't have a really clear sense of what the common good is. You know, they're not committed Christian people who think, I really want to save the world, and so I'm going to align all that I do to save the world, in whatever that means, you know, eliminate poverty or whatever it happens to be. Climate change, whatever. So my own personal opinion is the boys with toys sort of thing is the best way I can actually understand what's going on with these enormously wealthy people who can afford to make these toys. But others will have a go at me for that and say, you can't psychologize Sam Altman or Elon Musk or Peter.
Chris, I had to ask a question, didn't I? You talked about the problem of AI constructing these essays and reports that the students need to write. How does what do teachers, professors, lecturers, what are they going to do in the future to determine whether they're reading a fair dinkum essay or a fake one?
Yep. And education authorities the world over have been working very, very hard in the last few years to answer that question. I can think of answers to the question, but the point is we are not going to bother testing for example, grammatical correctness anymore. We will just expect all essays to be grammatically correct. We're not going to test for structure of an essay because all essays ought to be structured well. What we will test is for understanding. One way forward, which we haven't instituted where I teach, but one way forward is to say, great, we don't care how you write your essays, just produce your 2,000-word essay. And within the week after the essay, we're going to have a 10-minute conversation about your essay. And we're going to ask you, why you quoted Aquinas here? And why did you say this? Or could you explain to me this sentence? And very quickly, we'll find out. Now, if the student used AI to create the essay, that's fine. But then the student has to go through the essay and understand the whole essay if they're going to pass the oral exam. So that's one way of dealing with it. The student still submits 2,000 good words of well-argued logic, but they get probed a little bit to make sure that they really understand it. Not that they wrote it, but that they understand it and can defend it. That's one example. And there are lots of other ways education authorities are working to work out how to test students appropriately in the light of this.
Yeah, last question down here with Mark.
Sure. It'll be a zinger.
I don't know if it's going to be a zinger. thank you. That was really, really good. I really enjoyed that. Thank you for going so broad and deep and across so many areas. I really appreciate it. I asked ChatGPT to review your writings on AI and to say what, if any, criticisms could be made of them.
I told you it was a zinger.
This
is fascinating,
and,
Mark.
And then having
what
done
did it
that,
say?
Then I can tell you later. It would take too long now, but I can bring it up. And then I said, what question should I ask Chris Mulheron about AI? So it's come up with four options. So I'm going to ask you one of them. And this is the question. Do you believe AI could ever be morally accountable? And if you don't believe that, how should we protect people? Should we let AI create autonomous systems, that is where they run without human intervention? Or what guardrails, if any, could we put around autonomous systems if AI cannot be made morally accountable?
That was three questions. No, I don't think, in my personal opinion, the whole concept of artificial intelligence is totally ambiguous, isn't it? Does it mean it's intelligence, but it's artificially created, but it's really intelligence? Well, we certainly haven't got to that yet, and the question is, will we ever get to that? Or does it mean it looks like intelligence, but actually it's only artificial intelligence? It's pretend intelligence because it's very sophisticated. We can't tell the difference when we type into the screen and it responds. So there's that question. I don't think AI, which is based in pure numbers and neural networks and computers, I don't think that it will ever be intelligent in the way that human beings are intelligent. That's a core conviction that I have, but it comes out of my core conviction that human beings can never be represented as just a set of numbers. That is to say, I think there is more to human beings than the information contained within our brain and the information contained within our bodies. So if it can never be intelligent in the way that human beings can be intelligent, then I don't think it can be morally accountable. The people who make the systems can be morally accountable, and they're the ones who have to work out how to put the guardrails around the systems. And I've got, you know, that's a technical problem, how you make sure that your artificial intelligence that's driving the world's nuclear devices doesn't make the wrong choice. I keep putting inverted commas around it because I think only human beings can make choices, decisions, but it looks like the computer's making a decision. How you put the guardrails around, I don't know. My biggest concern is that there's not actually agreement in a diverse culture, just looking at the Western world, there's no agreement on what the common good is, on what the outcomes ought to be, let alone including all the rest of the world. You know, the Western world, roughly Judeo-Christian heritage, but all the rest of the world. So what rules should Elon Musk follow? He reckons going to Mars is much more important than eliminating famine. And he reckons, he probably doesn't think this, but if he reckons going to Mars is the answer to climate change, let the Earth burn, but let some of us get to Mars, he's got the money and the power to do that. So, yeah. So my biggest concern is that we don't have a conversation where we're arriving at agreement about what we ought to do with these enormously powerful tools.
Talking and sharing and responding to the questions. So I'll give you a round of applause, Malik.
You're welcome. Can I do a very brief advertisement for IsCast?
Please.
If you like this sort of thing and if you think this sort of thing is important, we in Australia are IsCast in Australia is trying to promote that, but we are completely funded in terms of most of our work, apart from our school's work. Most of our work is completely funded by people like you, by individual donors. Sign up to the IsCast database and get our free emails, and if you like what you see, become a member or send us a donation. That'd be wonderful.
No worries, thank you. I'll just pray briefly and then we'll do a couple of other little things to wrap up. Father God, please give us godly wisdom. Stay here, Chris, moment. Give us all godly wisdom as we interact with ever-evolving technology and AI, and help us to navigate the journey forward as things change and evolve constantly, and to remain firm to you, to your ethical framework as given in the Bible. And pray for Chris as he continues to navigate this with IsCast, navigating this area and teaching at the ACU, et cetera, give him godly wisdom as well, and may he be a spokesman for truth and light in this ever-changing world. In Jesus' name, amen.